there were so many issues with people with bulimia in my school that the rule the school brought in was that you couldn't go to the toilet in the lesson immediately after lunch. It wasn't let's deal with body image or let's deal with these girls' relationship with food. It was just let's stop them going to the toilet on that particular moment. So all of that, there's something for me about maybe B'Tselem Elohim is really about how we see God in ourselves. And therefore that image of when we look in the mirror, we see God reflecting back at us, and that getting part of that healing is getting to a place where you can look in the mirror and be comfortable with what you see back. Hello, everybody. It's so exciting to be back. A huge, huge thank you to Shoresh and to the Movement for Progressive Judaism for financially making this possible, for bringing me and my wonderful colleagues, Rabbi Robin Ashwistein and Rabbi Debbie Young Summers, back together so that we can chat. Because really, I feel what they're doing is enabling our friendship to blossom, our opportunities to actually schedule time in our diaries to chat to each other. And if that means that we need to open it up so that other people listen, I mean, that sounds fair enough to me. How are you both?
I'm good. I do sometimes forget that people are listening. We should try and remember that.
It's worse when people quote me back and I'm like, how do you know I said that?
How are you doing, Robin?
I'm so excited to be back. I also liked how Miriam said my name. I feel like you put the accent in the middle, Robin Ashwistein, which I quite liked. I might introduce myself like that from now on.
Go for it.
Robin Ashwistein. Yeah.
It's a gift.
So yeah, great. Happy to be back.
Good. And it feels nice on a January day, cold, and it's very sunny, but it has been raining like nonstop. To be able to start the new year, I hope, recharged, refreshed, and ready to embark on all sorts of new projects for the year. But I feel that as it's really our only controversial topic of choice that we ever disagree on, I feel like I have to just go back, you know, into the depths of just a week or so, a couple of weeks ago, and say, how was it for you, that festival I don't talk about? Tell me the best thing you ate during the festive period.
It's quite hard to choose, actually. I think essentially, we didn't go away. So almost all we did was cook and eat and, you know, go to indoor activities. But Gary did smoke a turkey for lunch on the 25th of December.
I heard that
we have a smoker.
Yeah, we have a smoker. I was interested where it was going.
Yeah. Our meat smoker in the garden. And it was delicious. Turkey is one of those meats that can be quite tricky to cook. And this smoked turkey was moist and delicious.
Interesting. All right. Nice to hear. What about you, Robin? Any culinary amazingnesses?
Well, not turkey, because as you know, vegan. I actually had a guy, he knocked on the door yesterday and he was trying to sell. He's like, oh, I'm a fish man. Do you want fish? I was like, I'm vegan. I was like, he didn't need to know all of that. I could have just said no. I'll tell you, I had the loveliest thing. We went to St. Andrews, which we do every year. And I went to the Cheese Toasty Shack, which is actually quite famous. It went viral, all because of the woman who owns it and how she celebrated her body. It's really interesting. And maybe I'll speak about it a bit more. It's this toasty shack on the beach in St. Andrews. So I had a vegan cheese toasty looking at the waves crashing. And it was like just beautiful and so tasty.
That sounds amazing.
Like it was so good. I want to go back.
Love the idea.
Now, Miriam, you were away. So what was the most delicious thing you ate?
I was away and we did eat amazing food. We tend to do our big holiday of the year in the winter so that we could actually get some sunshine and appreciate it and be excited. And we were in the Philippines. And actually, I have to say, one of the best meals we had was actually all Israeli falafel shawarma, this amazing place in Manila. And there's just something about when you're somewhere so far from home and so different and so foreign. I mean, I love Asian food, but there's nothing quite like walking into an Israeli restaurant speaking Hebrew, kind of that piece that is, you know, we're from the different four corners of the globe, and yet there's this thing that brings us all together. And it's not just really good falafel and really nice hummus. It's actually just that sense of a feeling of community and wanting to back those kind of restaurants and meet the Israelis that were in there, and had emotional conversations with people who had recently been in the army. And I think it was as much the food as the company and the kind of feeling of what it really means to be kind of Klal Yisrael at those kind of moments. So it was definitely a highlight, definitely a good thing. So I don't know, you probably have a more highbrow level of TV watching than the Berger family. But the three of us do like to make sure that we keep up with the wheel. So even though we were away for the live broadcast of It's Christmas Special, I was kind of fascinated by one of its questions that asked what the average calorie intake by a British adult is on the 25th of December. And I'm not asking you to guess the answer, although we could leave the answer for the end of the podcast just to make sure that our listeners listen all the way through. But I was just kind of fascinated by what it says about us, that that was either something that we, that, you know, somebody had recorded, and B, that that question was asked. What do you make of it?
So we did also watch The Wheel. I think one of the things that happens over the winter holiday period we kind of start nesting. There's a kind of desire to stay in and warm and cozy. And we do love a Christmas special, even if it's not something we watch regularly. So yeah, we did catch The Wheel and we did see that question. And I think you're right. There was this fascinating calculation that went on between the contestants of, oh, well, if you eat that and if you have that, and that's 200 calories and that's got to be another, and you're eating the whole box of celebrations and other chocolates are available. And that sense of what is it to be in that headspace of thinking through what's the calorie content of everything I'm putting in my mouth at a time when actually we want to just enjoy and feast, and we're allowed to do that occasionally and to just enjoy the food. Are we allowed to just enjoy food, I suppose?
Yeah. I watched that question because it came up on Gogglebox, which is one of my favorite programs of all time. Love it. Quite obsessed. And so I got people talking about it in the program, and then everyone on Gogglebox also then thinking about what they consumed. And I started to feel like kind of, I went back on what I ate on Christmas Day. Apologies, Miriam. And
I think you've told our audience before once or twice that your dad's not Jewish. So you
That's right.
go Gazinta hate, celebrate with him. I'm glad for him that you could, that Thanks. You're there to celebrate for him.
Although my mum always celebrated it in the East End, well, Jewish. Anyway, we use my dad's as an excuse, I think, to eat all the stuff on Christmas. So I started then to feel kind of guilty and like, oh my God, how many calories did I have? Which is really annoying because not only, like Debbie said, is it a time that, you know, like treats are good and indulging is good. It's also winter and like, I still am not ready to start the year. Like, I want to hibernate. I'm not ready to, like, the new kind of new year, let's get going, all the new projects you mentioned, Miriam. I'm like, it's deep winter. Like, I'm still want to be in that. I want to be eating. I want to be hibernating. I reckon for spring, that's when one of our new years is. That's when I'm ready to go. And that's when I'll be more active and all of that kind of stuff. So, yeah. But whenever I hear food spoken about in family or online, it comes with a whole set of emotions layered upon each other. And that question certainly opened it into a more kind of public conversation.
As a clergy team, we've been having this conversation. And I caught it in what we're doing and saying as well, which is we've started already this early in the podcast saying, oh, well, that's good and that's bad. This is bad food. This is good food. Snacks are good. Snacks are bad. Right. Food in and of itself is not a moral value. It's food. How we choose what we eat is, you know, a bigger societal question. But the use of the words good and bad, naughty, I'm being naughty, I'm being good, right? It does have a value judgment that it puts onto a person who's enjoying a bit of food.
It's really interesting. And I could, you know, we could take this totally off in a different tangent, which is the book Wintering, which I think is really fascinating.
My favorite.
It's a brilliant read. And it kind of gave gave an understanding to me of like how I do naturally feel at this time of year and why Pesach is very much a much better time to be our New Year celebration. But sticking with this kind of food and how we use it to celebrate and how we sort of punish ourselves with it and reward ourselves with it and all sorts of other things. Do you think Judaism plays into that? Does it buck the trend? Is it all part of the same issue? Or do we have a kind of different sense of relationship with food, but also maybe with body image? Where does Judaism take us in that kind of direction?
There's so many ways to answer that, isn't there? I think there's textual answers to it of the Hebrew Bible of how like women are portrayed. I'm sure we'll talk about that and how people, you know, how appearance and body image plays into it. But also culturally in Jewish spaces, I've had, which is really lovely in the last few months, lots of family simchas. And the amount of conversation about body image at those moments over the kiddushim, you know, the food and drink after services, at the dances and everything is kind of astonishing and it makes me so angry. So I think culturally, because we're not, you know, apart from society, we are part of society. But culturally, Judaism is highly focused on food. Every festival, there is a food attached to it. Most of our communal gatherings.
Or a fast, which can also be a problem.
Or a fast, which I struggle with. Yeah, exactly. Both ends of the equation. And there are always conversations around body image, around family, you know, family meals or in synagogues, in communal endeavours. So I think culturally that we've got a lot to unpack and move forward with.
We do have that combination, though, don't we, of the ability to both use food to show our love. And I think there is something about kind of feeding people, showing love for them, having them over for dinner. Well, you know, even whether it's welcoming the strangers, the ushpizin, our guests into our sukkah, or having the strangers round the Pesach Seder table, there is a real value to, you know, Abraham and Sarah's tent of welcoming people in as soon as they arrive, feeding them, giving them drink, that is how we show that we care. And that was definitely something that I inherited from my mum, was very much the mum who, if you're sad, let me give you something to eat. If you're, you know, if we're celebrating, let's go out for dinner. If we want to show that we're friends with people, let's have them round our Friday night table. And yet the distinction between that and body image, it was as if there was absolutely no correlation. My sister and I always tell the story of when La Senza opened in Brent Cross. La Senza was the first kind of pretty underwear shop in Brent Cross. And it was like a great excitement for teenage girls that this was suddenly a sort of a place where you could go in. And I just have this very strong image of the three of us, me, my mom, and my sister, walking in there together. And my sister picking out a couple of pairs of knickers to be bought. And my mom looking at them going, well, if you're a size small, what do thin people wear? And wow. The horror of like that kind of comment that we're still able to like only laugh about today, like changing rooms in shops was always the time when my mum would be like, Miriam, you know, you know, you could feel so good about yourself at moments like this if only you ate less. And yet she was also the person going, let me feed you.
It's so interesting because I think when I was that age, La Senza wasn't an option of a store I could even walk into, right? I knew there would be nothing in there that I could even try on, even as a teenager. There were, in the 90s, maybe two shops that I could buy clothes in. I think it was Etam and Evans. And, you know, I was a big teenager and that I was very self-conscious of that I couldn't just buy stuff anywhere. I did buy a lot of clothes in Camden Market, and that meant that my style became quite hippie, gothy, divvy, because they were kind of drawstring and, you know, flexible. But I think it feels like one of those things that I've just kind of carried through my life, but I've really journeyed with, and it's changed quite a lot over the years. You know, I was at Weight Watchers before my bat mitzvah. And the diet industry and the attachment we have to food. You know, we are also the generation that grew up as ultra processed food really came into its own, and, you know, convenience food was really coming into its own. We know that these aren't really questions that people have struggled with in the same way that we do today, because the industrialization of our food production has impacted our bodies and how we eat as well, and how, you know, we have to eat, but a lot of these foods are now quite addictive. And trying to measure something that is needs to be healthy, but also can be a pleasure and can be a treat. And of course, you know, rewarding ourselves with food, comforting ourselves with food. And it's so embedded in Jewish community life. We do have, I think, a lot of complicated relationships with food in the Jewish community, because it's such a present part culturally of how we do everything.
Yeah. And I think I'm really interested in the weaving of the things that you started us off with, Miriam, around kind of what we inherit really from, particularly through the, as we're all women, through our mums, through the generations of women. I know in my family, they've really all struggled with weight and body image issues, and that inheritance of what we inherit, but also like what we choose to pass on. And I know I've been on a real kind of re-education also as at Weight Watchers when I was, I think, about 15 or 16. I'm trying to re-educate myself with the language that I use, and not using food as reward or punishment, or it being good or bad. Trying to take out that moral value and what it is to be healthy and not, and trying to pass that on to Gabriel to change language, which I'm really grateful for, that we're in a moment that feels that we're kind of, our eyes are maybe more open to it. And yet we're still quite far from it. And I know that, you know, it's quite difficult sometimes when you're rabbi in a space and you're kind of more public, that the body feels like something that can be commented on by other people. So often, however hard I'm trying to re-educate and be gentle with myself around, you know, how I feel with my body and my appearance, it's very difficult when other people then start to comment on. One comment I had after a service was, wow, your breasts look great in that dress, which was coming from a really nice place. Like, it wasn't creepy.
Creepy.
Well, it was from a woman. It really wasn't. She would often like comment on how nice my dresses were. And I, you know, but it's that thing of then just being really self-conscious, but I'm like, you know, I'll tell myself, it's not about me. No one's looking at what you're looking like. It's about serving God. It's about the service. And you step up and someone's, you know, saying all sorts of things, or commenting on whether they think you've lost weight or you look great, which is, you know, I never say to anyone if they've lost weight, because there's a kind of an implicit thing that you look better now, which is rubbish. So
I'm feeling very seen, Robin, to coin a phrase. I mean, I just relate to everything you've just said so much. And I actually have a friend who stopped talking to me because I didn't notice that she'd lost 5 pounds when I had just lost about 2 stone, and wasn't actually thinking about my own weight loss particularly, because I'm looking out at the world from who I am. I don't really feel or see the change. It changes how everyone acts towards me. And there was a point at the end of rabbinical school, actually, where I lost a huge amount of weight. And I discovered that the world was much nicer to me, which I still feel really sad about. People smiled at me in cafes and restaurants in a way that I'd never experienced before. People were never smiling at the fat person, and I still wasn't slim, but it is really different how people treat you. And I really appreciate that sense that you have, Robin, of how do we change the language around it and change it for the next generation. And and we're still so far from it. I worked really hard having one of the funny comments I've had, I mean, there are so many, but when I was first pregnant and I first put my, sort of 3 months, and I put my baby on board badge on, a congregant saw the badge and said, oh yes, I thought you were pregnant. I saw you'd put on a lot of weight. Which was just such an unnecessary way to acknowledge a pregnancy. But also, you know, we have tried, or certainly we did when our kids were much younger, to use fat as a word that's a descriptor. It is neither negative or positive. It's just a descriptor of what our bodies are like as a family. And we try to think about what it is to make sure we're being healthy, but that we are fat. And when my daughter was in year one, that started to unravel because a kid in reception called her fat. And her best friend said, "Don't call my friend fat." And it was at that moment that she discovered that fat is an insult. And we tried so hard to stop that happening. And it's really tricky. You know, I've absolutely the same. You know, people will literally stand around in synagogue discussing how I've lost weight, asking, you know, telling me off for eating a piece of cake because I've been doing so well. It's really complicated stuff. And on the one hand, I know that they say it from a place of love and wanting to pay you a compliment. But actually, why should our body shape matter or be a compliment or an insult?
Yeah. I don't know if you've heard about the amazing project, and Debbie, I think you have, called Fat Torah. It's fattorah.org. And it feels really like on the edge, which is kind of crazy because it shows us on the cutting edge of what we're trying to do. And it talks about ending weight stigma in Jewish communal life. I'm just reading from their goals, confronting fat phobia, equipping people who work in fat activism, and also, which is really interesting, propagating, which is a great verb, a methodology of connecting with sacred text, tradition and spirituality that fosters body liberation for all sizes. And I have to say, like, I am not there with body liberation. I talk the good talk, and it's probably one of the last struggles I have that I really struggle with is around body image. So this kind of work feels really important. And also, I think when your eyes are open to this stuff and you open the Torah or the Talmud, it is screaming at you. Just in prep for this, I was looking at a text from from Tractate Ketubot, which talks about what do you say if you see an ugly bride. Do you, you know, comment upon that or just say she looks great? And the male rabbis talk about, well, it's like if you were to bring something and buy something from a market that was inferior, would you tell the person who bought it? Which is just an awful analogy as well. But these kind of appearance discussions are embedded within the text. So what do we do with that? So I think the fact that Fat Torah is getting to the heart of it also through text and the cultural bit seems really exciting. And it's kind of crazy to me how cutting edge that feels. Like, I think we're sort of only at the beginning of all these journeys, really.
It's an interesting time also to be having this conversation, because I feel we're in a place where the sorts of things that both of you have been saying about, like, where we should be able to get to in that narrative, you know, where I recognize I'm like almost of a different time and different era, because I know how validated I feel when I come off the bimmer and someone says, "Oh, you look amazing," or "I love that dress," or and I know I shouldn't, but I know I still do, and I know that's, you know, not healthy and all of those things, but I have to own it, and that's kind of where I'm at. And yet, the other side of that is people being given on the NHS, you know, medication in which to make them thinner. And actually, when you then hear about, like, what is classified as like a healthy BMI, actually, like, you know, it is kind of, I would go to as far as saying it is thin as far as like what health is and what has become kind of normal in terms of our shapes and stuff, is not necessarily within that thing of still healthy. And so I feel it's an incredibly complicated world in which we're being marketed food that's not good for us and addictive and all of the things that you're saying. We're being...
And much cheaper.
Right.
It's so much cheaper to eat that rubbish.
And quicker.
You know, processed stuff, absolutely.
Right, quicker, it doesn't go off as quickly, you don't have to shop for it as often, all of those kind of things. The convenience life is being marketed to us with millions of pounds behind it to be able to get it to us. There's the piece that says we recognize that actually what we inherited from our mums is not how we should look at our bodies and everything. And yet we're still within a world that values us to look at a certain way. And, you know, I'm totally fascinated by what you said, Debbie, about, you know, people smiling at you and that kind of thing, because there's no way of knowing whether you gave more of yourself. Maybe you felt more confident. Maybe you gave something off into the room, which was, I'm happy in myself, that people then reflected back. I don't know, because I wasn't there and I don't.
I tend to be a bit of a smiler. My kids criticize me all the time for grinning at complete strangers and, and being friendly to everyone. And
I'm always worried they might be congregants, so I smile as well.
But I think that that medicalization of this is a really important part of the question. And, you know, these injections and drugs have changed the conversation for a lot of people. Some people I've seen really proudly posting on Facebook saying, you know, I've never been able to manage my weight. This is the first thing that's ever worked for me. And it's changed my life and it's fantastic. Other people who are really super secretive about it. And I think, you know, the health question is a really big part of this. But being different body shapes and sizes doesn't implicitly mean poor health. I think also that the value judgment that goes with it implicitly suggests that those who are bigger are weaker somehow, have no willpower, aren't as disciplined. There are huge numbers of value judgments that are made. And it's been interesting because I have been losing some weight very, very slowly over the last year or so. And I think for a lot of people, there's sort of, oh, is that the injection? And I don't actually, it hasn't been, but I, why should that need to be justified or not? If it was, it was. If it wasn't, it wasn't. But it's that, you know, the value judgment that we put on other people's bodies. And I do think the medical question is really, really tricky because we want to be healthy. But I do have a terrible story of a GP who was helping me in the 2000s to try and lose weight for health purposes, and also because we knew we wanted to get pregnant and we were going to need IVF, and I couldn't have IVF at the size that I was. And we tried various NHS programs that didn't seem to be working. And at one point, he wasn't Jewish and he was very close to retirement, but he basically said to me, you know, Debbie, this stuff isn't working, but really no one was fat in the concentration camps, which I didn't say it in the moment because I was so flabbergasted. But essentially what he's saying is you need to be trying starvation, typhus and hard labor, because you can lose weight. Those people weren't fat. So why are you fat? And I just,
oh my God,
the stuff we carry with us because of things like this is enormous. And I don't know, like, earlier when Robin was talking, I actually found myself welling up with tears at all of these memories of people telling me that they want to help me, that I would be better if I was smaller. And it's a lot to carry because it's been all my life, really.
Right.
It's a huge amount to carry. And that story is just, I don't even have the words.
I
told us just beforehand and I'm as speechless as I was then. But I think, I mean, those things are, they're so harmful. I remember my grandma who also really struggled with her weight. I must have been about 12, just walking, nowhere near your story, but walking across the room and she just said, Robin, you must suck in your belly and stand straight. And that kind of thing then sits in your body for the rest of your entire life. But I think what I love about, as a segue, being Jewish is, or being Jewish critical thinkers, is that we're kind of enjoined to think about the Peshat, the literal stuff, but also to go much deeper to the sod of what's secret, what's really underneath all of these narratives, what's being said. And I think one of the most interesting things for me is, who is it benefiting? And we speak about women because I'm in a female body, for us to be so obsessed with what we look like. Like, I will often be more obsessed about what I look like than what is happening around me, or the job that I'm doing, or the potential to make connections or whatever. And I think there is something that in this kind of globe, in this world of capitalism and everything, that wants us to be completely obsessed with getting thinner, doing everything for it, because we're distracted then from actually being able to look outside and to kind of create and be disruptive in that way. So I really do also think there's something very, for me, social justice activist Tikkun Olam, like it's a Tikkun for me personally, of a healing for me personally, but also by not being so obsessed with that, it enables me to do the work that actually needs doing, rather than just, I always think to myself, I do not want to get to my deathbed and just think, that, you know, like I'm still in that space of like self-hate and questioning whether I'm the right shape for whom. You know, I always think I just want to be in a different place where I am now. And that, you know, and thinking in that kind of way of like Tikkun Olam makes me think it is a bit different. It kind of helps me a bit more, I think.
I did find when I turned 40, that it was almost like a switch went in my head.
Yeah.
And I just stopped caring somehow what others think. And I don't, like, there are still moments I do, obviously. It's impossible to completely switch off. But I suddenly realized I love myself and I love the body I'm in and I'm okay. And if I lose weight or put on weight, it's not for anyone else.
Yeah.
It's my journey and it's my body. And I want to look after myself as well as I can. And I want to be happy.
There was a book I read a while back and there was one sentence that really struck my heart and like my being. And I blog about tattoos, things that I would have tattooed. And actually, I should do a blog on this and this one. I don't think I have. It's a book called The Book of Longings by Sue Monk Kidd. And she has a whole prayer written in it. And one line says, "Bless the largeness in me, even when I fear it." And it links to me to that point of what are we not embracing then if we're so focused on body and being smaller? And actually, I try really hard. And it's good for that I've just remembered this because I forget it all the time. And then I hear it. And I think, yes, bless the largeness. Like I want to be abundant. I want to be in the world. I want to be like creating change. And bless the largeness within me, even though I fear it. I think on so many levels is so helpful to me. So maybe for our listeners as well, to try and find blessing in the largeness of our being, of our doing in the world.
I just think that's beautiful. And also, largeness is not just physical. And I think we're quite often asked to make ourselves smaller in lots of ways, particularly as female leaders. Resisting that is really fascinating. And sometimes we do it naturally in a different way and lead in a different way because of it.
So if we could fantasize about kind of the community of the future or a society of the future, where being created in the image of God, B'Tselem Elohim, was not about the kind of generations of that we're holding on to, whether that's also from our text, like the way that Rachel and Leah are distinguished between as siblings, right? We're told that Leah has weak eyes and Rachel was shapely and beautiful. I mean, that's how they were set apart from each other. A bit like Jacob and Esau, right? Being one was smooth and one was hairy. This was how they were defined, separated as sisters. But if we were able to put down the generations of definitions of women and what we should look like and all of those kind of things, which I have to say is only partly our societal norm, right? I remember part of my upset. We had a cleaning lady when I was a child who was from Ghana, and she used to say, "Oh, Miriam, you're so fat," and, you know, pinch my cheeks and say it super lovingly, because in some societies, particularly when food is scarce, actually, like, it's a sign of affluence and beauty. So, yes, it's complicated.
My mum used to tell me the Pre-Raphaelites would have loved me because of my curves and bumps.
I love it.
That standard of beauty does shift and change over time. And actually, being wealthy enough to have food in some cultures and in some generations has been the bonus.
Right.
And actually, maybe survival. Our obsession with being slim is because the food is poisoning us now.
So if we were able to get to a point where we could define B'Tselem Elohim in the image of God on our own terms, what would it be to you?
I think about this quite a lot, and I very rarely think about it in terms of body image and body size, which is quite interesting. For me, B'Tselem Elohim is human diversity, because God is so diverse, and it's our collective humanity that is hugely diverse, that for me is a symbol of the diversity of trying to understand the incredible breadth and depth of the divinity. But I think the idea that we are all in the body we should be in is important in that.
Yeah, that's helpful. It makes me think of what I wish for is a kind of joining or recognition that the physical is spiritual, that they're not separate in some way. So you bringing in B'Tselem Elohim is really helpful for that, of that, you know, being attuned to my body and accepting of others in that diversity, there is something linked with the spirituality and physical that they're not separate. I think I can't really unpick it. I need more time to think about it because it's such a good question. For me, the physical becomes completely untethered from the spiritual. That's part of the problem. It's like an idol almost, that it's all about trying to get thinner, or it's about what I'm eating. And exercise is contingent on the food, not about just being active and healthy. And there's something about integration of the spiritual, of divinity, of being connected to the value within, and that kind of inner spark that I kind of hope for. That there's kind of integration of that, that it isn't this kind of idol that we hold up separately.
I wish I'd thought of the question early enough to think of the answer myself, because I've got the beginnings of an idea that I hope you'll be able to help me with the text behind it. There's a beautiful piece in the High Holy Day Machzor that describes our relationship with God as if we're looking in 70 mirrors or some image that actually, as we look in the mirror, we see God staring back at us. And for me, listening to both of you today, but also knowing the crazy, the crazy relationship I have with like food and my own body and feeding other people and all of those kind of things, and knowing what I've inherited and where I've come from. And, the 90s was a particularly crazy time. I mean, there was so much. I was at an all-girls school, and there were so many issues with people with bulimia in my school that the rule the school brought in was that you couldn't go to the toilet in the lesson immediately after lunch. It wasn't with body image or let's deal with these girls' relationship with food. It was just let's stop them going to the toilet on that particular moment. So all of that, there's something for me about maybe B'Tselem Elohim is really about how we see God in ourselves, and therefore that image of when we look in the mirror, we see God reflecting back at us, and that getting part of that healing is getting to a place where you can look in the mirror and be comfortable with what you see back. You know, for me, there was nothing worse than leading services on Zoom throughout the pandemic, seeing myself rather than the community. Like, I was just like, this is awful having to.
You can't turn that camera off.
Then I was worried about what other people were looking at. So then I had to make sure it was. Anyway, but that thing of what does it mean to feel comfortable in that.
But I think that's also a really good reminder that actually, you know, food and our relationship to it is really complicated, in the sense that sometimes being slim is not healthy. And coming into Jewish spaces filled with food can be really complicated when you have an eating disorder. And fasting is a really terrible idea if you have anorexia. Naming these challenges and creating spaces, as I know we've all done in different ways, to acknowledge for people, you don't have to do this if it's dangerous for you. You know, we need to be able to speak about our relationship with food and the complications of it. It shouldn't be something we're ashamed of. And it manifests in so many diverse ways for different people. When you mentioned the Machzor Miriam, like what I thought you were going to quote, but although I love the one you did quote, was a piece I think Lionel Blue wrote in one of the confessions, that I have worried too much about other people's souls and my own body and not enough about my own soul and other people's bodies, in terms of feeding them healthily and looking after others physically. Mm. And I shouldn't be worrying about their souls. I should worry about my own soul. And I think that dichotomy is a really fascinating one in terms of how we frame, how we look after one another in this conversation.
That's so beautiful.
It's interesting. I just recently made, as for Wellspring, a podcast with a consultant psychologist, Stuart Link, about the sort of relationship with alcohol within the Jewish community. And we were particularly looking at Dry January and what that all about. But the exactly what you were saying, really, about community's relationship with food and feeding each other, and those coming into those big spaces with food, when if that's a challenge to you, we run the same problem with alcohol as well. It's that challenge both of society and tradition that's so embedded in all we do.
I think that's, for me, that's why the spirituality piece is so important, because I know that when I've lost weight, and I've had, you know, I yo-yo all the time, but when I have like lost a lot of weight, I've not been happier. And I'm always like, oh, but I thought it was about this. And actually what it's about as we know, is about self-love. It's about compassion. It's about belonging. It's about being fulfilled. It's these bigger things than just giving. Again, it's an idol, the number on the scale, and trying to inhabit that love and fostering it within ourselves has to be like, it's a spiritual practice. And I have to say, I'm like really moved and feel very empowered and still, and quite vulnerable having this conversation. And it makes me think, I don't think I've had these conversations in community actually ever, really, in a way of actually being able to talk about it. And I'm really grateful for it. And I do think that it's a big, you know, we need to keep having more of these conversations because I think it's kind of at the heart of so much stuff that we carry.
I know the Eshet Chayil, the quote from Proverbs that's often used on a Friday night as part of Kiddush, is given a bad rap by kind of feminists and the imagery of women that it gives. But there is a great quote within that says, grace is deceptive, beauty illusory. It is for her fear of God that a woman is to be praised. And, you know, that sense, I think, is something we can definitely take from this conversation, that actually, I think all of us as women, particularly at a certain time in our lives, our bodies are changing. I certainly look in the mirror every day and see my mum now in a way that is part of that process of entering middle age. But I think it's part of remembering what we're all about, and that these are just vehicles, and that we need to keep the vessel healthy and doing all that we can to keep ourselves alive and well so that we can keep teaching, keep learning, and hopefully keep making the world a little bit easier for everybody in it.
Can I also clock just on the back of that this affects men as well? And, you know, men struggle with this too and struggle with the comments. And I do think it's different and unique and for every individual, really. But it's... yeah, let's change the conversation maybe. But I like Robin. I'm really grateful to have it.
It's nice to be back having any conversation with you both. And I'm glad that we've got this new series ahead. Robin, how can people keep in touch?
Well, as head of social media, and what did the producer Dan call me?
Creative
director. I think creative director sounds a bit fancier. So as creative director of the Rabbiting On podcast, you can follow us on Instagram at @rabbiting_on_podcast. Just rolls off the tongue. Do follow, share it, put it on your stories, do what you need to do. We'd love to get some conversation going there about how you've found us as well.
Lovely to chat with you all, be back in conversation. Can't wait to see you in a couple of weeks.
Yay, so good to
Lovely
be back.
Lovely to see you guys.
Bye.
Bye.
Rabbit in, rabbit in, rabbit in, rabbit in on. Rabbit in on.